on America Can We Talk, I talk about election integrity, border security, healthcare freedom, race relations, energy and tax policy, education policy, free speech and assembly, freedom of religion, and all other issues that touch on the God-given right of every American to life, liberty, and the pursuit of their version of happiness. Stay tuned. You preach your tolerance, but lecture me. Is there no end to your own hypocrisy? Your God is power, you have no shame. Your only interest is political gain. You hide your eyes and refuse to listen. You play your game.
Coming up next, America Can We Talk with your host, Debbie Georgiatos.
And hello and welcome to America Can We Talk. I'm Debbie Georgiatos. Today in our show, we're going to talk about rogue political Texas State Bar exposed. Jace Yarbrough joins me in studio as a candidate for Texas State Senate. Great stories to tell you. Further fallout from the 2020 election, Israel abandoned by America. Trump's charade trial raises America's banana republic rating. And finally, Berkeley's conundrum, Israel-Palestinian protests and free speech. And of course, I'll tell you why these stories matter to you. So to start our show today, I want to just do a quick story. It's not only relevant to Texas, however, it is extremely interesting to Texans. And this relates to our Attorney General Ken Paxton, whom we've talked about many times. Ken Paxton is widely regarded around the country as among the most conservative and effective attorneys general in the country, in part because he's willing to take on the harder cases, the ones that involve more controversy, potentially involve people who will become critical or attack him. And he did file in the at the end of 2020, early 2021, he filed a piece of litigation in Texas at the U.S. Supreme Court, along with other states, essentially making the argument that because the 2020 elections had so much indicia or evidence of, I like the word fraud, but simply irregularities, he asked the Supreme Court to look at it. And it was a great argument he made, which I'm not going to dive into again today. Point is, he raised at the Supreme Court. So the Texas State Bar, which even governs an attorney general, the Texas State Bar had brought action against him, essentially arguing that it was a frivolous kind of case. So I want to tell you what's happened. The point I'm telling you all this is, there's now a case before the Supreme Court of Texas, and this involves not only Attorney General Ken Paxton, but also his first assistant attorney general named Brent Webster, who was also helping in that litigation tying back the 2020 elections. Case before the Texas Supreme Court, and a coalition of attorneys general around the country filed an amicus brief, friend of the court, amicus brief, to the Texas Supreme Court, openly saying that the Texas Supreme Court ought to entertain the idea, look at the idea, that the Texas State Bar pursued this punishment of these two lawyers, and that because it was political, or that they were politically motivated to bring these claims against him. So in court, the basic language these attorneys general brought in was a blatant case of politically motivated lawfare launched by the State Bar of Texas, or calling it politically motivated lawfare. And these, again, tie back to the original complaints against both Webster and Paxton in their decision to file that landmark litigation. Texas versus Pennsylvania was actually the name of it. But the language I want to talk about briefly, the brief explains the real question in this case is whether courts will permit the politicization, I love that word, of the state bars and the weaponization of disciplinary rules against elected executive officers discharging their constitutional duties. I just want to make 3 points about that in this case in our first five. Number one is that there has been a lawfare against conservatives in this country in a whole range of issues. And this lawfare concept, it mainly is what people talk about with respect to President Trump. And we'll talk about him a little later in the show. This lawfare's idea is using the courts, whether it's civil litigation or even bringing criminal prosecution, to essentially force a political opponent out of a race, to force a political opponent to endure shame, ridicule, and therefore sway voters, not not sway them by the way campaigns should, by speaking up about ideas that matter, speaking up about your policies, whatever you're running on. But lawfare is a real perversion of our voting system in this country, because it's an attempt by leftists in this country to attack conservatives and sway public opinion, sully the reputation of those people. And so that's a general observation that we have a massive problem with in this country. We'll talk later about what's happening to President Trump actually today. But the second point about this is that sometimes you think, and I used to think as a lawyer and a member in law school, thinking, I just held the judiciary in such high regard that they just, you know, these are people. I know in our big corporate law firm in San Diego, two of the more senior partners moved on to the federal bench. And they were just truly, they were stellar lawyers. I knew them both well. They were, you know, just honest people, hardworking, really bright. The process for them to go through to receive a seat in the Federal District Court in Southern District of California, it was huge. Investigating their background, everyone that knew since second grade, that's an exaggeration, but they really checked in their backgrounds. You go through that background check and you kind of assume that lawyers who make the federal bench, they become federal district judges or appellate court or Supreme Court, that they've really been vetted. And vetting isn't just what is their background and whether they engage in conduct, you might question, but it was really about their character, their intelligence, their capacity to maintain the neutrality which is required by judges. And because I knew about that, and because in law school as well, I went to law school in Washington, D.C., and I used to live where I could literally walk from my happy little apartment in law school. I'd walk by the Supreme Court, cut across the Capitol grounds to go over to Georgetown Law School. It was the coolest thing. I dropped in on the Supreme Court. You used to be able to go there, by the way, just show up at the Supreme Court, listen to arguments. It was fabulous. I used to do that. I used to think it was the richest experience ever. The point, though, is I really held the judiciary in high regard and had a presumption of their integrity. I will say, because of the treatment by the federal courts, especially in the Washington, D.C. circuit, the way they're treating January 6 prisoners, January 6, in my view, political prisoners, the failure to have some sense of equal justice, it's evidence that this radical leftism that has inflicted our country, invaded our mindsets, has even made its way to the judiciary and even made its way, in this particular case, the Texas State Bar. The notion that the Texas State Bar would actually go after the Attorney General for filing litigation that relates to what was a highly questionable election in 2020 and try to use it as a basis to remove him or to at least censure or punish him, this is pure politicization. It's like a mouthful word. Politicization. But I love that the attorneys general around the country weighed in to point out they're basically saying, plain English, this is a bogus case. This is a bogus case politically motivated by people who do not like someone as brave as Ken Paxton has been challenging the election and many, many other issues. I do believe the state bar action toward them is political in nature, and I love these other attorneys general spoke up and said so. I hope the Texas Supreme Court will look closely at what that amicus brief is arguing and actually rule based on what they had to say. And the third point, and then we're going to go to our happy guest here today, but the third point in all of this arena of going after lawyers, prosecutors, and judges, and actually challenging either with criminal prosecution or challenging their bar license, what this is a massive assault on the First Amendment. I just read before we started, I just saw the headline, so I'll quick tell you headline. The Supreme Court rejected Sidney Powell, a friend of the show many times. Sidney Powell's appeal, she asked for a review by the Supreme Court of the 2020 election, essentially the lawsuit, the litigation against her, and the penalties against her. She asked the Supreme Court, look at it. They today declined. What I'm getting at is, if you can use the First Amendment to shut down people who you don't like, which is fundamentally what the idea of the First Amendment was to encourage robust debate of ideas, encourage the idea that individuals have the right to not only speak as they will, obviously some exceptions, like fire in a crowded theater and such, but pretty much the First Amendment is very, very, should be very broadly interpreted, was over the centuries until recently. You also have the right to hear. The First Amendment, the Supreme Court has ruled, includes the right to hear what others say. Your First Amendment rights are interfered with if you don't get to hear opinions others wish to express. And so what is happening with the Supreme Court and with, excuse me, what's happening with the First Amendment is lawfare and the threats to individuals, threats to lawyers who try to challenge things that Ken Paxton did, threats to doctors who try to raise their views about what they think about the COVID vaccines, what they think about the various other treatments available, threats from the state bar as to lawyers, state medical board as to doctors. It's a rising acceptance, even among the educated class in America, that the First Amendment can be used to just shut down people whose views you'd rather not have the public hear. It is a true threat to the very foundation of America, this assault on free speech. Talk more about that later, but for now, that, my very fine friends, is today's First Five. So we have joining us in studio, it's a great thing today, we have joining us today Jace Yarbrough. He is running for Texas State Senate in Senate District 30, SD 30, and we did have here in the great state of Texas, we had our primaries in March. We're now in runoff phase. So this is a runoff between Republicans, which is the vote is the end of May, May 28th, a runoff between two candidates running for SD 30. And Jace Yarbrough actually met at a political function, I think we both spoke at, but in any case, met him there. I'd actually been hearing about him, and I wanted to have all of us have a chance to say hello. So welcome to the show, Jace Yarbrough.
Thanks for having me on, Debbie. I really appreciate it. Good to be with you.
Good to be here, sir. So you are running for state Senate, and this is your first political campaign ever, is this correct?
That's correct. First time out. That's right.
Why in the world? You know, I will tell you, Texas is in an uproar, you know, politically speaking, and the Senate and the House are. So why are you going after this at this point? And we're going to get back to your background, but quickly, why are you into this?
Sure. I think everybody has a vocation. I have a couple of vocations. One of those is politics. And so I've served as a precinct chair for the party before, and I canvass my neighborhood and text my conservative friends when it's voting season and first day of early voting. And so I thought one day I'd run for office. Why we got in this particular cycle, this seat in especially is a little bit of an odd cycle because of a very late and unexpected announcement by the incumbent that he was not going to seek re-election. There was a lot of speculation about a couple of prominent figures who were maybe going to come and run for the seat. Both of those gentlemen decided not to. I, along with several grassroots leaders and groups, as well as elected officials in the district, were, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks away from filing deadline and very concerned about the only options in the race. We live in the lines have since been redrawn, but our district, had it been drawn this way back in the last presidential, would have gone for President Trump by 23%.
Wowie.
So we live in a very, very red Senate district, and our conviction was we needed to have a very, very red option in the race. And so we got in on the last day to file in order to provide that to the people of Senate District 30.
Okay, so you had a primary, and I'm sorry, five total candidates?
There were four of us in the primary.
Four in the primary, emerged with two, so no one got 50%. You're off to the runoff now. So
that's right.
I do want to, the conservative voice thing is a big, big thing. And because I think, you know, this nationwide show, people think, oh, Texas is red through and through, and not so much. I mean,
correct.
We have Republicans who, it's a wide range, even within the Republican Party.
Yes.
So we'll go back to that in a minute. But, you know, I want to do your background because I think, I want to talk about your background a bit because I think it does help people size up you as a candidate.
Sure.
So if you would just, I mean, especially your military background, but quick, tell us about your background.
Yeah. Raised in a blue-collar family in a tiny town outside of Abilene, Texas, called Tuscola, about 700 people. Had a great upbringing. Mom and dad were together while I was growing up, going through school. Was in church every Sunday and every Wednesday night. Went to college down at the University of Texas in Austin, studied electrical engineering and government down there, and then graduated, did a couple things, but joined the military, was active duty Air Force. I was an engineer for them. Led technical teams to develop new capabilities for DoD weapon systems, great leadership as a young lieutenant, also served in the Honor Guard in DC. So I was a flight commander for a couple operational flights within that very historic ceremonial unit and have buried almost 100 veterans in Arlington National Cemetery, which was a privilege for me. My wife and I had our first though while we were on active duty and we wanted to live near family while we were raising our kids. So got out, went to law school out at Stanford Law School. I was there from 2015 to 2018. So Trump's election is right in the middle
of my time
there, which was a red pill moment for me. It was a wake-up call as to what's actually going on in our culture, what the aims of the left are. And I'm grateful for that experience. But got done with that, came back to Texas, and Dallas was the biggest legal market near home. So I worked for Baker Botts, which is a very historic, well-known Texas-based law firm, and cut my teeth, grew up as a baby attorney there, and got to work with some really great people. We had differences of opinions about, among other things, the COVID-19 shot, And so I ended up moving on from that, and then eventually went in with a buddy. We do conservative cause litigation for profit, so we're not a nonprofit. We do have paying clients, but we take on sometimes we call it the radioactive docket. We take on a lot of really important conservative litigation. It is a good word. Yes, we have an office which we do not go to frequently. I say jokingly it's for hate mail and anthrax, but really great work that we do, and I'm really proud of it. I continue to serve in the reserves, so I'm still an engineer for the Air Force as an active reservist, actually sitting in a Space Force billet right now. So anyway, it's a little bit about my background. I married my high school sweetheart. We have 5 kids. We started a little classical Christian academy with some close friends and family last year. That's going very well. So a little bit about me.
That's a lot about you. That's wonderful. So did you just say you're still active reservist? That means you're called up?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit different than a traditional reservist. I'm attached to an active duty unit, and that gives me some scheduling flexibility. I usually go and serve for a little over a month. If you add up 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, that comes out to about 5 weeks and some change. So my current unit is at Patrick Space Force Base out of Cape Canaveral. So that's where I go for about a month a year.
Okay, and so you are still in this active practice. You and this one partner are still active practice in law, and you take the radioactive cases essentially.
Yeah, we do partner with other firms depending on the nature of the case and other attorneys. So we generally have help in the cases that we do. Some of them we do on our own, but yeah.
So it's all litigation.
It is all litigation. Yes.
State and federal court, or
that's right. State and federal court practice all across the country.
Okay. Plus, I like that you founded. I read that in your bio that you founded a traditional school, a traditional Christian academy. I mean, honest to goodness, I was hearing recently with some friends we had dinner with about their kids. Not, I'm sure it's not your school, but one of those schools where the depth of learning kids get at a young age when you really can set the curriculum yourselves is mind blowing.
Yeah. Yes. So, yes. It's been a blessing for us, certainly. Yeah. My wife she's a trained teacher. She was a school teacher before we started having children. A middle school choir actually was kind of her preferred thing, but she's done a phenomenal job. And we've had great conversation as she really dove in and started reading about philosophies of education, and we were talking through what we wanted from our kids. A lot of the stuff that I had studied in college, you know, political theory and philosophy, really came back. And you know, education is a very important and foundational, you know, discipline. And so it touches on a lot of things. So our marriage has grown through it for sure as well. That's also been a blessing.
Absolutely, it sounds completely wonderful. Just wonderful. Okay, so back to your campaign. You're running for Texas State Senate, and you know, I will say, everything's relative. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, and so I think people look at the Texas legislature and say, wow, look at all the great things you got done, but other things didn't get done. So what are the issues that drive you in the legislature, if you're in the Senate?
Yeah, border security is number one issue, and then immigration, and I think it's important to distinguish between those two things. They are different, but without a border that we control, we can't have an immigration policy, and we don't have a border that we control right now. At the end of the day, there is, you know, we can't ultimately keep, as a state, we can't ultimately keep immigrants who want to come over illegally from getting into our country, right? They can't enter from the border with California or New Mexico or Arizona. But we can do everything in our power to, one, fortify our own border, and then, two, make our state inhospitable for those people who are here without our permission.
Inhospitable meaning?
Meaning that we should make this the last place they want to come if they're here without without permission from us.
Meaning benefits, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. Eligible. In-state tuition rates, you know, E-Verify for Texas employers. I think one of the things we should do is look at our identity theft laws, for example. People that are here pretending to be someone else so that they can work, right? That's something that we should absolutely crack down on.
Yeah. As you know, as a lawyer, there's been a battle over how much Texas can do to enforce the border because it's supposed to be constitutionally the federal government.
Yes.
So do you think Texas could do more of the physical protection of the border?
Yes. So I think there are two. When I think about this, I think about a couple of issues. One is the policy side. And then there's a constitutional issue that I think we need to come to terms with, particularly judicial supremacy. So I'll talk about each of these very quickly. The first one, we need our own border protection unit. We need a unit that is specifically dedicated to protecting and preventing folks from coming across our border without our permission, without our leave. Right now, we have a temporary solution. We're using DPS troopers who are sort of, you know, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. My brother was a highway patrolman when Operation Lone Star kicked up. He actually got out of the highway patrol because of the strain that cycle put on his family. Then we use National Guardsmen, another big piece of the force that's down there protecting our border. Biden has already threatened to federalize that. He does that, we no longer control it. We elect President Trump in November. That's the best thing we can do in the immediate term. But of course, we're not always going to win the presidential. And so the time will come when a new Democratic administration comes in. They will remanufacture this crisis. Texas has got to get to the place where it can permanently seal its own border, regardless of the federal government. As to the constitutional piece, we bought into this idea of judicial supremacy in the 20th century here in America. So if the Supreme Court says something, we think, oh, well, we must all do it in all cases moving forward from now on. And that has not been the American approach to constitutionalism. And I think we need to encourage our elected officials and those constitutional actors within our regime to rethink that. And there are some historic precedents for doing that, to say, look, I have my understanding of what the Constitution says. And one of those things, for example, as the governor of this state, is to protect my citizens, my community. I'm going to stand up under that obligation as I understand it, and do everything I can to do that despite what the Supreme Court says in certain instances.
Okay, I'm trying to think. I love that you said that last point. There's a website, Conservative Review, and I can't think of his last name, but he's a brilliant writer, and he wrote about, I mean, this is maybe 5 years ago, the farce of judicial supremacy, and he went through and all these things. He specifically listed, I think it was like 10 things that Congress could do to rein in the concept, just the deference to judicial supremacy. Yep. I do think with some people, you think, well, we have three branches of government, we all know this. Mm-hmm. Someone's got to be the final decider, so I guess we all agreed on Supreme Court. That's how people feel like, well, at least it protects order. Sense of it.
Yes.
But when they are rogue, as we have, you know, and when it's not consistent with the will of the people, you have to reopen that question.
Yeah. Well, I would actually say that a more restricted or narrow view of the judiciary's power is consistent with America's longer standing practice. So when I'm on the campaign trail, I talk about Abraham Lincoln. He's stumping, debating Douglas, running for president in the late 1850s. And the question comes up, the Supreme Court just decided that Dred Scott and his wife, even though they've lived in a state that's free territory, and under the laws of that state would be free men, have to go back to slave territory with their master because that's what the master wants. The question is posed to Lincoln, would you enforce that? And he says, well, the Constitution requires me to honor the decisions of the Supreme Court, and so I would honor that decision. But notice that decision applies only to the parties and the issues before the court. So if you want me to treat any other slave similarly to Dred Scott and his wife, then you will have to get a new decision from Justice
Lincoln Payne. Said that?
That's the thrust of his response.
I mean, yeah.
That's the thrust of his response.
I did not know this. Great.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That's
so
great.
And the idea comes up, right, when the federal government says, no, you Texas have to allow the federal government to come in and remove the concertina wire.
Yeah.
That you have set up, right? We need to be rethinking, okay, well, this is an issue from the Supreme Court, but the power of the court per our Constitution is not universal in this sense, right? So what are the options that I now have as a governor, for example? And we should encourage the governor to continue to push back and protect us in the ways that he can, given this decision by the Supreme Court, which, again, is limited to the parties in front of it and the issue presented.
I think that's brilliant. Okay, I looked it up while you were talking. In fact, one of my listeners texted, Daniel Horowitz, great writer at Conservative Review, and he urges people, he's just a really good thinker. So he wrote, obviously not that specific thing, but this point about just kind of, unbridling our thought from this notion of judicial supremacy is the be-all and end-all. Okay, so you're running for Texas State Senate. We have early voting starting May 20th, I think.
Correct.
Mr. Emilio, can you put up his chyron, if you would, please? I'll make sure everybody can see your website. Okay, so we have jaceforTexas.com, J-A-C-E, jaceforTexas.com, and at Jace Yarbrough, I guess that's on Twitter, or an X.
Correct.
Okay, so if people can, they can go to your website, they can learn more about you.
Yes.
They could probably donate money, could they?
Absolutely, they can donate money, and I would be very grateful if they would.
Okay, donate money, and also volunteer, because this is a traditional door-knocking campaign battle.
Yes.
Correct?
The Senate districts in Texas are huge. We actually have more congressmen than we have Texas senators, so our districts are larger than our congressionals. I have roughly 1 million constituents in Senate District 30, similar to all the other Texas Senate districts. So we couldn't knock every door if we wanted to, but we do want to knock many doors. And we knocked some 22,500 in the primary phase, and we want to knock many in this phase. So yes, please do come. We have a number of ways that you can pitch in and help if you support us and you align with our values.
Love that. So last thing I want to ask you about, there's somebody else running, because this is why it's a runoff, one other person.
That's correct.
And I know he's been a, he was a chair of the county party where you are at some point. Yes. I don't know what his whole story is. So there's a lot of controversy around him, and I don't live in that county. So quickly tell, what is the story with your opponent?
Yeah, so my opponent, a couple of things. He was the chairman of our county party for a time. In the last 18 months, he's been twice condemned by the county party. There's a long-running feud between what I would say is, you know, they describe themselves as more grassroots conservatives and then folks who are have been a part of the political apparatus for a while. My opponent certainly falls in the second category, and whenever it became apparent that the conservative grassroots were probably going to take over the party apparatus, the folks who were in power did a couple things that were underhanded to try and make sure that they control at least a piece of that power moving forward. And so you can go to failedleader.com, actually. A number of precinct chairs put up this website with their details about you know, their complaints against my opponent. The latest instance, and in particular in this race, he does not live in our Senate district. So he has $1 million lakefront property in another Senate district where he voted as late as the November 7th, 2023 election.
Okay. Is that state law in Texas? You have to live in your Senate district?
Our Constitution requires that you live in the district for which you want to run 1 year prior to the election.
Okay.
For us, that's November the 5th, 2023. You have to have lived in the Senate district by that point. So there's an ongoing litigation challenging his residency. You can find some details about that online as well, but that's a little bit about my opponent's background.
Okay. Well, Jace Yarbrough, I know you have a really busy campaign, so I'm glad you happened to be available. Thank you for coming and joining me today.
Thanks, Debbie. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Great talking with you. Okay, my very fine friends, I'm going to hit three more topics, if I believe we are going to. I call this next one Further Fallout from the 2020 Election. And I say that because, as I've talked to you many times before, and as Barack Obama was actually just loved saying, you know, elections have consequences. That was a famous Barack Obama, which is, I guess, a truism. It is true, they do. But partly what Barack Obama meant by that was he was going to engage in the fundamental destruction of America, which is what he did. He didn't mean transformation. He meant destruction of the American ideal. But he engaged in that and kind of had the attitude of, you know what, that's right, elections have consequences. Well, we're seeing that now in the 2020 election, bringing us into he who now occupies the White House. Biden has really changed the world in many, many ways, changed the safety of the world, and changed America's strategic alliances. In particular, I'm thinking about, I want to talk about Israel today. You know, we many, you all have to be aware that Israel has now suffered a rocket attack launched by the Iranians. And the Iranian, apparently, the Iranian rockets, which, you know, were headed toward Israel, were largely intercepted by Israel's defense forces, which was pretty great. But Iran is, you know, it's a Islamic jihadist administration. I mean, the mullahs are just jihadists, as they embrace Islam. They embrace the radical, you know, jihadist mindset. And so they are forever and a day hateful of Israel, hateful of Jewish people, hateful of, you know, Christians and America while they're at it. And so this attack on Israel was, you know, it was retaliatory, of course. But I want to go back and just have us think about what would it have been like had President Trump been in office when this occurred. Number one, I do not think Hamas, that lives and is the government, is a terrorist, murderous, jihadist organization. That's what Hamas is. They're also the government of Gaza, elected by the residents in the Gaza Strip. They attacked Israel on October 7th in the most impossible, you cannot overstate the grotesque, violent horror of what occurred on October 7th, and unprovoked, 100% unprovoked, and except if you take the long view that Gazans and people who support Hamas do not think Israel has a right to exist, or that the Jewish people of Israel have the right to live, which is how they think. So they had a horrific attack on October 7th. And since that time, which I don't think would have occurred had President Trump been in office, terrorists in this world are emboldened by the presence of our present U.S. government, the Biden team in Washington, because they understand the Biden team will not stand strong with allies, won't stand strong basically between right and wrong, won't stand with Israel. Now, Biden has made a little bit of noises first on when he took office saying, oh yeah, Israel's our pal. But he has since that time, in many, many ways, viewed to be abandoning Israel. So we now have the point where Israel took out two senior leaders, Iranian jihadists, took out those people in a very, strategic, but, you know, laser-focused attack. Israel showed its strength in IDF, the IDF has Israeli Defense Forces, and took out these two leaders that these Iranian jihadist types, and in very a laser focus. It was like they practically knew which room in the house they were in, a room in the building. It didn't hit the building next door, didn't hit the store down the street, just those people. And so Iran, you know, felt like they claimed they felt like they had to retaliate. And so Iran rained rockets down on Israel. And I want to mention just a few things about, you know, I talk about this so often on the show about the importance of defending Israel. Israel is, I don't have the map ready today. We've showed it many, many, many times in this show. But if you have a map of the Middle East and you have a little red dot that shows what Israel is and the surrounding countries, North Africa to the east and the west of Israel, to the north, all around them, they are surrounded by Muslim-majority countries who, in varying degrees, impose Islamic Sharia law, impose Islam on their people. They have, in varying degrees, you know, portions of those populations who are flat-out jihadist. That's who surrounds Israel. Israel's on this tiny little dot in the middle. And on top of that, the Gaza Strip in Israel is just a tiny slip of land, relatively speaking, within Israel. It's on the west of the western portion of Israel. So Israel has a tiny little place in the world that is carved out for the Jewish people who are, you know, back to the homeland of their ancestry, of their, you know, millennia ago. The Jewish people have occupied this portion of the world, Jerusalem and surrounding areas. That's what Israel is. And, you know, the notion that America tries to, and two more things about Israel. They're the only government in the area that actually even has anything remotely approximating Western civilization and representational government. They actually have an elected Knesset, Congress. They actually have an elected leader, and the people can recall the leader if they want. They can choose new leaders. So they have representational democracy. I mean, they have a system there that allows everyone who is in Israel, whether they happen to be Jewish or they happen to be, any background. Christians live in Israel safely and can vote. People of the Muslim faith can live in Israel safely and vote. People who are Arabic by national origin live in Israel. It is a melting pot like America, and it's in Israel, and all those people have the same rights to vote. And so it is like what we're trying to tell the world: look how great America is. You can be like this. We Americans have that here. We try to say, look at Israel, you can have, you know, Israel is an example, surrounded by countries that are intolerant of other religions except Islam, have varying degrees of mistreatment of their own people because they support radical Islam. And so this is where we are. And so we had the October attack last year, and you would think anyone even approximating Western civilization would recognize that, of course, Israel has to defend itself. They have to fight back against Hamas. They have to get into Gaza and fight back against Hamas. In case you didn't know, although I've covered it and many others have as well, the cowards who are the fighters on behalf of Hamas literally, physically place their weaponry and their troops behind, or put the other way, they push in front of their troops and their weaponry and their ammunition piles. They push innocent civilians. They push children, women, hospitals, schools. They go out of their way to hide their troops and their ammo and everything they have to engage in war, and hide it behind innocent people, recognizing that when Israel is trying to get the bad guys, trying to get Hamas, there will be unfortunate loss of innocent life. But this is, if you don't like that happening, you don't like scenes in Gaza of children and families and hospitals and schools being destroyed, point the finger at Hamas, not Israel, because this is the most cowardly conduct imaginable, and it is just standard operating procedure for Hamas. So this is where we are in 2020, well, now we're in 2024, but when the attack happened in 2023, Hamas is hanging out in the Gaza, putting innocent civilians intentionally in harm's way, and trying to make it impossible for Israel to defend itself, or make it impossible, if Israel tries to do it, for Israel to escape blame because people turn on them. So back to where we are right now, you know, we have Israel not being really helped very much. In fact, there's was almost an instant call on the United Nations to say, you know, to call for Israel to engage in a ceasefire. You know, I don't recall the UN ceasefire demand as to Hamas, which Hamas has attacked Israel over and over. But Israel tries to defend itself, tries to push back against Hamas, and the world's in an uproar, and they actually had a United Nations declaration of a demand for a ceasefire, which America failed to intervene on Israel's behalf and stop. I'm getting around to where all of these things I'm telling you would be different. The actions occurring today in Israel would be different had we not had the 2020 election debacle, the theft of the election in America, where we have the current administration, they who occupy the White House, engaged in essentially not only abandoning Israel as our most common ally, but really it was reported, and I can't, obviously not firsthand, but reported in responsible sources that Biden not only knew that Iran was going to attack Israel, but that he okayed it. He kind of was okay with it, you know, just hit certain areas and be okay. Now, I don't know if it's Biden personally. I doubt it because I think he has dementia. I don't know, think he knows what's going on. But people who really run the country under his administration, or actually over his administration, seem to be permitting this Iranian attack. And we're at a very, very fragile point right now in the Middle East because we have Israel saying, we're not going to stop fighting in Gaza until we get all of our prisoners back, the POWs, the kidnapped Israelis who were kidnapped back on October 23rd last year, the kidnapped October 7th of 2023, the kidnapped American citizens, or excuse me, Israeli citizens still in Gaza, and you know, Hamas not being pressured by anybody to release them, and Hamas not in the slightest backing off and saying, okay, we realize Israel has a right to exist. We will stop. Hamas will not be stopped until they will not stop until they are stopped by Israel. And once you recognize that undeniable, unchangeable dynamic, you can never figure out how to solve things in the Middle East. So now you have America, formerly a strong ally of Israel, and certainly during the Trump administration, he moved the headquarters of the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, because that is their real capital after all. You just had a more peaceful situation over there. The Trump administration brought along the accords that brought many, many people into acceptance of Israel and trying to find a way toward peace. In fact, one quick thing, you know, Jordan, which is obviously a Muslim majority country, but Jordan's military was actually fighting on Israel's side, shooting down the rockets that Iran was sending in. You know, I want to go off on this story. I can't get uber down to details, but except I want to say, these are, you know, the thing I started this segment about, elections have consequences. It matters if you put people in power who understand anything about the dynamics of the world, dynamics of Israel, and understand, you know, who's the bad guy over there, and understand why Israel has to continue to go after Hamas in Gaza. Because if they don't, if they don't root out all of the Hamas people in Gaza, if they don't root those people out, they'll have another October 7th event before too long, because Hamas lives for its entire purpose, as jihadists as they are, to destroy Israel, to kill Jews. And eventually, it's not just them, it's us, because also just woven into the fabric of Islamic Jihad is hatred of certainly of America and of Christians. One more point, so back to, you know, Biden, he who occupies the White House. There was a call between Biden and Netanyahu, which people aren't sure why the call was released to the public, but it was, whether it was deliberate or unintentional. But Biden talked to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is kind of the Trump of Israel in any case, and told Netanyahu that the United States would not support him if he were to retaliate against Iran after the terrorist-backed country launched the attack on Israel on Saturday. Just please think about that. Iran is, I mean, they launched rockets into Israel, and Biden is telling Netanyahu, we're not going to back you if you defend yourself. I mean, the whole concept gets so, I mean, it starts to give you a little bit of a window on the crazy of leftist national security policy, leftist thinking about world policy. Because the overwhelming push by Islamic countries in the world is just to eventually eviscerate Israel. America used to recognize, with our Judeo-Christian heritage and our respect for the kind of governance of in Israel, that we have to defend them. And many violent jihadists in this world figured out America actually will defend Israel, and so we better watch out what we do. So, fortunately, Marco Rubio, a Republican senator from Florida, he accused the White House of deliberately leaking the audio to the public. And Rubio is saying the reason that the Biden team leaked that was to appease Biden's anti-Semitic supporters or gain more votes back for Biden in the 2024 election. You know, it's astonishing to me that we have, I mean, it is well known that anti-Semitism lives on the American left in this country. It's truly staggering because they're normally the ones telling you, the left, that they live to defend people and the right to live in freedom. They're the ones who love people. And yet, that's the home of anti-Semitism. It is the left in America today. Leftist institutions, leftist professors are full of hatred for Israel, and yet they still get somehow, they're the party that cares. We're the party that is to be chosen in elections because we look out for people, we care. So there's a Rubio, one more thing on Rubio. Marco Rubio, I do like that guy. He was quoted as saying, they know Israel's going to respond. They know it for a fact. So why would the White House leak that? Why is the White House leaking that they told Netanyahu, we won't back you if you fight back against Iran after what they did to you? And he said, this is Marco Rubio, there's only one reason they leaked it, is so when Israel does respond, the White House can say, we told them not to do it. And some way, at least, they will be appeasing the so-called peace activists. We're going to get back to the peace activists in the end of the last show, segment of the day. But anyway, I want to just share all that with you to say, you talk about just further consequences of this stolen election of 2020 is we have just at the very, very least, people who have no sense of the international significance of Israel, of what Hamas stands for, no sense, at the very least, profoundly ignorant. The reality is there are people who are just, they find it so much easier to pile on with the globe's anti-Semites of the world, pile on with them, join in that. That's who governs our country. So they aren't standing up for Israel even after that attack. And we'll talk more about this. We're going to have a national security guy on again in a few weeks, talk more about that. But, you know, people were posting all over social media, pray for the peace of Israel, and peace of Jerusalem. There is a need to continually pray for Israel, and it's protection from the hatred by which it is surrounded. And there was much of a great way forward shown to us when President Trump was in office, when he came up with the Abraham Accords, and which basically brought a lot of people together to say, in the Middle East, countries in the Middle East, to say, yeah, we're going to defend Israel, we're going to agree they have the right to exist, we're going to try to find ways to work together. So I want to hit two more stories if I can today. President Trump is in the middle of a trial this just impossibly ridiculous trial involving this, involving this alleged payment made to somebody who is a serial perjurer, and this involves a payment made that the argument about this case is that the payment should have not been characterized in the taxes in the way that it was. So let me just tell you the quick thing I'm talking about, and I think actually I want to make sure do a little bit of a deep dive into the Donald Trump challenges. Talking about lawfare, we were talking about lawfare earlier in the show. You know, you still have the case pending in Florida over the documents that the president had every right to take out of the White House and store them in his own home in Mar-a-Lago. That was his right, clear law, but we still have to have that prosecution ongoing. Georgia, that's a whole other issue we can talk about. But then we have this, in New York, we have this astonishing $450 million decision coming out of Attorney General Letitia James, which was basically this whole idea. And again, this is a judgment against Trump, and or is a fine against Trump, which had to do with his characterization and loan documents of valuations of various things. I mean, this is a case where there was no criminal, there was no victim, no harm, no foul, no even proven deception. It was just a case they found a way to go after Trump, and ultimately it resulted in this $450 million decision. So this is a, and what's really been going on, there's a great piece on this on New York Post, but basically lawfare, meaning the left's endless use of lawyers to try to attack their political opponents. They can't win on the merits. They can't win the merits of their candidates, so they win trying to take out their opponents. And so lawyers scouring civil and criminal codes for any basis at all to go after Trump or sue him or prosecute him before the 2024 election. And so, and to what I was just referring to a moment ago, this $450 million decision, a judge imposed a half billion dollar penalty in this case where there was no victim and no one lost any money in these loans against Trump. In fact, the bank officials involved in the loans testified in that case that they wish they could do business with Trump again, with the Trump organization, yet somehow a New York jury will do that. So now what they're involved in is a this case that is it basically took about 10 years to develop, involving millions of dollars litigation for all costs, blah, 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 blah. And it's basically this Bragg's first name. I'm trying to find his name. Alvin Bragg. So there was a, you know, there's a payment made while Trump is running for president to this woman he allegedly had an affair with. I have no idea if he did, but in any case, an alleged affair. And to keep her quiet and not interfere with his campaign for the presidency, a payment was made. That's the allegation. And so this is an argument that that payment made back in, now it'd be 2015 or else early 2016, should be the basis of criminal charges against him. And so this is a, you know, it's the most astonishing thing. Sorry, it's noisy and folding the paper. The most astonishing thing, this is a trial going forward. And by the way, in this case, people brought this case to Alvin Bragg's, Alvin Bragg's a few years ago, and just said, you know, Bragg, you can go after him for this payment. It was such an absurd claim, an absurd idea, that even Bragg himself said, you can't go after him for that's ridiculous. I mean, he dismissed it as ridiculous. And then just so he's saying this is not even, you know, close to possible as a real case. So now the case is going on, and again, it's a payment made to a woman who's changed her story several times about what happened, three times in writing saying that the affair didn't happen. So this is, but the case is now before this jury, and again, I'm telling you things you already know, but this is an unprecedented case against a former president. They have jury selection rocking and rolling back there to go after him over a payment from years ago, which was rejected by several other prosecutors saying that's a ridiculous case. But they find something that can get not only Trump's time stuck in the courtroom and also media headlines, the left just slathering themselves, just drooling over the idea of putting more and more headlines out there about this, and obviously hoping to turn more and more people against the case. And I will tell you that legal analysts brought this case up years ago, and even leftists were saying, that's crazy. You can't, that will not fly. It's not real. But the left is so determined to take Trump out that they're just going to go ahead and do it. They're going to see if they can somehow take him down on this case that involves nothing, that involves a payment, which, I mean, the thing is so crazy, it's hardly even worth discussing. But I want to get at, what I really hope you take away from this is not just that there's no basis for this case. There is no basis for this case. But the real point I want you to take away from it is just remind yourself, why the left is. Why is all this lawfare going on against Trump? Why are they after him in Florida over the documents case, in Georgia over a ridiculously baseless charge in Florida involving an obviously corrupt prosecutor who doesn't seem to care? Her corruption and philandering has been front page news. It just marches right on. Then you have the New York case about loans he made and a preposterous judgment against him over these loans for which no victim, no one lost any money, and actually the banks kept saying, gee, we sure wish you could have done more business with him. We love doing business with him. No victim, but they found a way to contort the laws into going after him. And even this one involving this woman and this alleged, I guess, pole dancer, whatever she was, stripper, I'm not sure she was. But the whole point is she's a serial perjurer. There was this is a basically misdemeanor kind of allegation turned into a felony. And then it tried in New York, where they know 9 out of 10 jurors hate Trump. So they just get every single factor imaginable against Trump. And just think of the audacity this all involves. These people in this case, these people pulling the strings, deciding to continue this prosecution of Trump, they're perfectly aware that on the Republican side of the aisle, he is the overwhelming favorite. He has now already won enough primaries. He's going to be the Republican candidate for president. And it's not like, you know, someone like Bill Clinton, who's, you know, or Hillary Clinton, whose conduct far more egregious. None of that ever makes its way to the courts. I mean, they just didn't happen. They just were free of any liability, responsibility for anything they did. But these people can dredge up cases from now, you know, getting on to be 9 years ago, whatever it is, 8 years ago, and go after him, do a jury selection, continue the trial. I mean, they know that they're trying to take down the choice of the vast majority of Republicans, and frankly, the overwhelming favorite to win the election in the fall. And it does not occur to them that they're being looked at as just petty, not just petty, but just vicious attackers of the American system, of the right of voters to choose their president. They concoct charges out of nothing, out of thin air, but they can do it. And there's nobody, apparently, in the entire judiciary in the state of New York, nobody able to say, Alvin Bragg, shut up, back off, drop this case. Nobody is apparently able to do that. No one can do anything. This rogue prosecutor brings a preposterous case, and yet the news is just drooling all over themselves, tripping all over their feet to get and report the latest thing and the latest outrage. And you just end up when, you know, whatever the outcome, I think that you really end up causing the American people, if they didn't think there was a problem of lawfare, they will now. If they didn't think there was a problem with the viciousness of the left to try to remove the presidential choice of the Republican Party, if they didn't understand how vicious, how biased they are, then you will understand now that it reflects badly on them. But I'll tell you the bigger point of it on Trump, and then I'll get to my last story in just a nanosecond. But what Donald Trump uncovered in his run in 2015 and 2016, and during his 4 years serving his first term, 2017 to 2021, those 4 years, what Donald Trump did, he awoke many, many Americans, millions of Americans, to realize how radically left the country had been dragged, not just by the Obama-Biden team. Big things happened those 8 years, but even before that, Donald Trump woke up the American populace to how far America was being dragged away from its roots in individual liberty, dragged away from its roots in the founding documents, the ideas of the Declaration, the Constitution, how far the left was dragging the American people away from the idea of self-governance, away from the idea of free markets and individual people with making their own way in life, with prosperity and making their own path, being self-sufficient. The left has been working at destroying the American culture of self-reliance, the American culture of belief in ourselves, love for our country, love for the founding ideas of America. The left has been working on that for decades. For decades. It came to a head in the Obama 8 years. People saw it. And when Trump came along and ran his campaign and pointed out, why is it okay with the left that more and more people don't not only aren't self-sufficient, but don't think they should have to be. They think they should live off the government, because all that happens when you live off the government is that the government becomes more powerful and more tyrannical. That's what Donald Trump helped people to see. He helped people to see, why is it the left is really okay with shipping jobs abroad and making trade deals that weaken the American people? And this slogan, or his mantra in the campaign of America First, it was offensive to many people on the left, but it caused Americans to realize the left doesn't like that. The left doesn't want to hold America up as unique and extraordinary and great. So what the real is really happening in this prosecution and all the lawfare cases is that people are seeing more and more firsthand, they're seeing the proof that what Trump exposed is dangerous to the establishment in this country, dangerous to not just the Democrats, but the kind of the uniparty establishment, that what Donald Trump is exposing, and many, many other things we don't have time to get to today, that he is so dangerous to them, they'll go to any lengths, including concocting an asinine case involving somebody who got paid something years ago, and it really is for something else, but it can be a front page jury criminal trial or jury in 2024, months before the 2024 election. I'm telling you, the American people do see through this. I do think that the left is harming themselves more than they realize. And I also think, even if they end up having Donald Trump sitting in jail, at the time of the election, he'll still win. By the way, I didn't get to read the whole story, so I don't know, but there was a headline talking today about the idea that one thing this ridiculous judge in that case has ruled, or the impact of the ruling, is that Donald Trump won't be able to go to his son's graduation. Yeah, not sure about that, but I think the concept, this judge is saying, what you're allowed to talk about, you can't talk about the ties, the judge's family, to the leftist power structure in this country, can't talk about that. They've made so many special rules in targeting President Trump in this case, and I think somehow, to some leftists, it all makes sense, it all seems fine and fair, but to the average, actually intelligent American who has their eyes open, you can just, it's raw exposure of the radical hatred of America, that hatred of the left, not really just of Donald Trump, but the American people who dare to support him. Okay, one more quick story, and then we're going to, I alluded to it earlier with our guest who was on the show, but at Berkeley, home of the radical leftists times a million, Berkeley has a professor, Erwin Chemerinsky. You know, he's been around like 100 years, I think. I swear, I've been reading stuff of his forever. In any case, he's a professor there, and of all truly astonishing things, so he's a radical leftist, and he's Jewish, and so if you're a radical leftist and you're Jewish, you of course hate Israel and never want to support them. In any case, among the things that happened at Berkeley, they hired that district attorney in San Francisco, Chesa Boudin, who himself was actually, even for San Francisco, was too radical, too leftist, that people recalled him because he was a district attorney who wouldn't prosecute any crime. Okay, that's an exaggeration. But basically, the city was going to worse ruin because of Chesa Boudin and his radical leftist ideas. Support criminals. Who cares about the people who work hard, the law-abiding citizens? You know, let them suffer. That was the view he took, and he finally got removed. So The Chemerinsky guy at Berkeley hired Chesa Boudin to head up the law school's Criminal and Justice Center. Just think about it. Just that is enough. The story could end there. You'd be saying, my gosh, these people are crazy. He actually hired on the guy recalled from San Francisco because he wouldn't enforce anything, would not arrest people, put him on as the head at Berkeley Law School of the Criminal and Justice Center. So there they have this Chemerinsky and his wife apparently have dinners at their home. They invite people over, students or whoever else they have over. They invite people over their home and have dinners. And I don't know what they do, talk about stuff. In any case, they had a really funny thing, which I find really, truly amazing. So the pro-Palestinian nuts at that campus, and you know, there are good points I'll make about this in a second, but the pro-Palestinian people, radical leftist student group showed up at his home to protest that he, because he wasn't radically pro-Palestinian enough. that showed up, disrupted his home. He's calling the police. He's complaining about, they're disrupting my peace. You know what? And so these are the people that are more or less on his side. These are the leftists on his side. So it's just kind of a comedy. He finally got a little bit of his own medicine because I think the police were reticent to break up these pro-Palestinian protests. And they are, of course, because the pro-Palestinians are scary. You know, you don't really, you get just piled on by the leftist media in this country. If you ever point out how violent the pro-Palestinian and how wrong they are, those protests. And so Chemerinsky kind of got a dose of his own medicine because the leftists, kind of in his mindset leftists, you know, even were too far left for him, disrupted his home, had a really hard time dealing with it, kind of entertaining. And before, one last point in that before I go to my why it matters to you, and that just is that my good friend Sam Favis wrote a piece talking about how there were pro-Palestinian marches that blocked major freeways in five major cities in America, blocked major freeways, big cities, to stand up for pro-Palestinian, and it was really hard to get the police to come to break those up. And I'm going to point out why, which is that these marches, these pro-Palestinian people get so much sympathy from the media that the police do not want to be the ones arresting them. They don't want to be seen arresting them. They don't want to be accused of, so they have a really hard time. And just stop and think, when someone says they are pro-Palestinian, what they're saying in this era, in this time, given what's happening in Israel, it means they are pro-Hamas. They are pro-terrorist. If you're pro-Palestinian in today's world, when the Palestinians elected Hamas, and Hamas is the murderous jihadist organization, you know, savagery in Israel last October 7th, that's who you're marching in favor of. And yet in America, we're so intimidated that the police really didn't want to have to break up the pro-Palestinian march. Just Stan Faddis's piece, making out the point, you know, how much further off the reservation of reality could we possibly be? Okay, I'm out of time. So we close our show every week by telling you why the stories we talked about today matter to you. So we start our show talking about rogue political Texas state bar exposed. Texas state bar effectively embraced the leftist 65 project to disbar lawyers who raise legal objections to election processes. Initiated proceedings to disbar OAG lawyer involved in the SCOTUS filing over 2020 state election irregularities. The 2020 election was fraudulent and stolen, and therefore irregular. Decisive evidence of the steal is at SCOTUS in the case Lake versus Fontes from 2022 Arizona election. The 65 Project politicizes the practice of law and weaponizes law against political opponents. No state bar should entertain such nonsense, much less disbar attorneys over it. Leftist assault on the rule of law will be irrevocably damaging, if not reversed. Texas State Bar needs to understand the evidence of the steal and reverse course on disbarment efforts. And praising the lawyers, the amicus brief that said we're not, you know, that they were wrong to go after Ken Paxton. Okay. Further fallout from the 2020 election: Israel abandoned by America. Biden administration's obvious pivot against Israel is heartbreaking for America and the world. America now led by muddled thinking that cannot or will not recognize the difference between a vibrant Israeli democracy and the Hamas terrorist barbarian organization. In the 2024 election, America must remove the leftist installed cabal. Nothing safe, secure, or good for the world can emerge from the Biden cabal's muddled direction. The 2024 election is an existential event for America. According to Victor Davis Hanson, are you voting for civilization or not? And Trump's charade trial raises America's banana republic rating. New York City farce show trial versus Trump is plumbing new depths of weaponized justice. Fines and jail time for violating an order to stop talking about the judge's obvious disqualifying conflict. Trump not allowed to attend his son's graduation. New York City elites live in a bubble where they believe their behavior wins universal attaboys, but the American people outside this bubble despise what is happening in this lawfare. Any rulings or result adverse to Trump will substantially strengthen and increase Trump's popularity. The American people have had enough, and lawfare is only adding to their anger. And on Berkeley's conundrum, Israel, Palestinian protests, and free speech, leftist Jewish UC Berkeley leaders finding out what they have sown. Benevolent dinners with students have turned into unruly pro-Palestinian protests. Jewish support of left rebel causes has blinded many to reality. The left ultimately hates God, hates the Bible, and most definitely hates the Jews. Islam does not embrace peace with Judaism. They are irreconcilable. UC Berkeley leaders are relearning reality. Will this red-pilling incident have lasting impact? And that, my very fine friends, is America Can We Talk for today. This Thursday, we have Dr. Richard Bartlett joining us in studio. Fabulous doctor from Midland, Texas, talking a lot about the latest he's learned about the next pandemic and the way it'll be sold to us and what we can do about it. So do tune in Thursday. I'm Debbie Georgiadis. My show is America Can We Talk. I do this show to speak truth about America because America matters. And I will talk to you next time.
Can We Talk? Truth about America.